Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James.
Namaste.
Before we get started, why don't you get you to check out our website?
Threw you off, didn't it?
A little bit. Yeah, it doesn't really, not the usual greeting from you on this podcast. It was needlessly polite. Yeah. Check out our website, themacguffinmen.com. We've talked about a wide range of topics recently, from Varsity Blues to Carrie to Point Break to Apocalypse Now. So those are all movies that are in no way related to each other. Although I guess the writer of Point Break also wrote Varsity Blues, so there's some relation. Anyway.
And they play football in both.
Yeah, that's true. So yeah, themacguffinmen.com. Also follow us on Twitter at themacguffinmen. I wrote a review of the movie Coherence that should be on songsandcigarettes.com by the time you hear this. So you can read that if you want, because Coherence was cool. But we're not talking about Coherence. We're talking about something else entirely. So.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, we're back from our weird opening credit sequence, just like the film we're talking about today.
Yeah, good point, actually.
Yeah, the majority of my, this is not a joke, the majority of my notes for this film are questions I have about the opening and closing credits. There were so many weird choices made.
Yeah, we were talking about The Fugitive.
Yes. Oh, I figured people knew from my preamble there.
The 1950s TV show.
Yes, no. Exactly.
No, the action movie, action thriller, question mark?
Sure. I prefer to call it an action movie. Just
okay.
Yeah.
1993, directed by Andrew Davis, written by Jeb Stuart. And if you're hearing this shortly after we recorded it, feel free to check out Jeb.
Sorry, the humor of your mic cut out because of the humor of Jeb Stuart's Wikipedia page.
Yeah, go there.
Yeah.
Just have a quick look.
We did not do it, but it's there.
Yes, it seems like something I would do, but yeah. It was not me. Yes, and also notably starring Harrison Ford and your boy, Tommy Lee Jones.
That's right. I have a question for you. Just
right off the bat.
Right off the bat. You have a problem with people with two first names, generally. Do you have a problem with people with two last names, like Harrison Ford?
No.
No? Okay.
Oh, I'm so okay with it.
Okay, fair enough.
And then pierce your left ear, and then I'm just sold for life, you know?
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, this is a, you know, we said action thriller kind of thing. Pretty well respected for an action movie, eh?
Yeah, especially for the time, it was kind of a cultural sensation.
Yeah, I kind of didn't realize it was as big as it was. I remember seeing this movie a lot while I was pretty young. Mm-hmm. So I know a lot about it, and you know, it was kind of important to me. But I didn't realize like it got nominated for Best Picture.
Yeah.
That's crazy to
me.
Yeah,
it was a huge, huge thing. You know? It was kind of like, you know, every once in a while there is sort of this blockbuster movie that becomes sort of bigger than just a blockbuster. Like, Christopher Nolan seems to do this pretty consistently now. The Fugitive was just kind of one of those, you know, just it had the right combination of things to make it be taken more seriously than maybe it deserved. And it was good enough that nobody complained and everybody kind of liked it.
Yeah, I did not realize it was kind of as much of a success as it was. Yeah. $368 million on a $44 million budget. Mm-hmm. Obviously, a nod for Best Picture is nothing to sneeze at. Mm-hmm. And I mean, this is a movie based on a TV show that's just kind of an action movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Tommy Lee Jones won a Best Supporting Actor Oscar out of it.
That is correct.
Simultaneously very surprising and very not surprising because he crushes this movie.
Yeah. As opposed to those other movies that he doesn't crush.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a reason he's your boy, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's the earlobes. It's all in the earlobes.
So, yeah, you kind of already touched on one of my next questions, but, you know, you said that sometimes a movie just gets kind of bigger than just a movie, like a mm-hmm. blockbuster kind of transcends for some reason. Mm-hmm. Why do people like this movie so much? And I, this is coming from someone who does like this movie.
I mean, it's not like it's a big part of culture anymore. Like, we over time have forgotten about it. It's not something that really endures, like, say, Forrest Gump, something from around the same time period that people bring up in conversation for some reason. And The Fugitive is not that.
No, it has, I mean, the jump from the dam is pretty iconic, but...
Yeah, exactly, but a type of iconic that really has faded with time.
Yes.
The reason this movie became a cultural kind of moment was because of Harrison Ford. I mean, it's as simple as that. Harrison Ford was the type of star that, if you put him in anything, particularly a type of movie that is so, you know, crowd-pleasing, it's just going to make a lot of money, particularly in 1993. Like, this is just... I don't know. It's Harrison Ford against the world, which is the type of movie we people have paid for over and over again up to this point. Yeah,
and it's obviously it's post the Star Wars trilogy. He's definitely an A-list star, and then this is just a vehicle for him to, what you said, kind of do what he does. He often plays the kind of reluctant hero, someone forced into a position, and that's what. Whole movie, you know, he's our lead, but he's someone who doesn't want to be the center of attention, but is kind of just put in this, you know, pretty tragic position. And, you know, he's on the run, but he's also chasing down the person who killed his wife. Mm-hmm. And you know me, like, you know me, I love a murder mystery. I love, like, the disguise movies.
Yeah.
So this is, and I love Joe Pantaleone. Like, this just is my big three things. You know? And it does all of those.
Yeah. Yes, it does have all those things, and it's got some. And it, what is his name? Is it it's Cosmo something?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. It's Joey Pants.
Yeah, exactly. It might as well have just called him Joey Pants. Yeah. I mean, it sounds like you like this movie more than I do. I quite frankly was bored during this movie. It honestly, like, it feels like a high grade TV movie to me. It's the direction is so boring. There's just not, like, they're in all of these giant wonderful places and the entire movie is shot in close-ups, and it was just, I don't know, there was just a lot of things that I'm like, this just isn't engaging. And I recognize I am in the minority here, but I don't know. I didn't find this movie particularly interesting, and I didn't even find it that much fun to watch. I just sort of felt like it was very, it was just kind of, I don't know, it was kind of like Taken. Like, it was a good example of a genre movie, but I don't think it was much more. And I like Harrison Ford. I like Tommy Lee Jones. This just, I don't know, this movie just didn't really get me too excited. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So you mentioned, you know, a lot of close-ups and the visual things. I'm usually someone, you think about visuals way more than I do. Mm-hmm. If I notice visuals, it's because they're normally very, very good or extremely poor. But that doesn't usually stand out to me the way it does.
It's Paul
for
Thomas
you.
Anderson or Uwe Boll.
Yeah, there's that one scene where he's walking on the train tracks and he kind of walks into that dark tunnel.
Yes, that's nice.
Yeah, and I thought, this is a good shot, and that was kind of the moment I was like, oh, I haven't noticed any good shots. This movie probably doesn't look good, does it?
No. That's a really nice moment, and it's funny, actually. Every once in a while, if I see something while I'm watching a movie on my computer that's like a really nice shot, I'll just take a screenshot of it. I did that for that shot and only that shot in this movie. That's a really nice, well-set-up shot. And that's kind of the extent of it for this movie.
Yeah, and it's just kind of a nice quiet moment in the movie that's
absolutely
often kind of really go, go, go.
And it's a moment where that kind of sort of visually tells a bit of the story without words. And
walking into the unknown, kind of.
Exactly.
On his own.
Yeah. And I kind of felt like a Key and Peele from that movie Heckler sketch at parts of this movie when I was just like screaming at the screen, it's a visual medium, don't give me just all dialogue exposition. It was driving me crazy.
Yeah. I did want to kind of say something about that in relation to Tommy Lee Jones. his job in this movie is like he has to do a lot of exposition. Oh, and yeah. That's the part of the movie, of any movie, that like you find that drags, you know what I mean? The part where they just have to explain things to you. But the scenes of him talking to his team are really entertaining. Like, they serve the purpose of speaking to the audience and letting everyone know all the things you need to know. But because they're so fast paced and it's Tommy Lee Jones being Tommy Lee Jones, it's simultaneously very useful and very, very funny. Like, it just doesn't get tedious.
Yeah.
And that's kind of one thing that I think, you know, makes this movie go at a good clip, is you can get all those things out, but, you know, the big dog saying it. So, it just doesn't drag. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure.
And what is it like just watching Tommy Lee Jones be in charge, but things not going his way perfectly, is just so entertaining. Like, I think I mentioned that on another podcast that we did, a Tommy Lee Jones movie. I don't know, type of charisma, but this really like dark, negative charisma that for some reason I could just watch all day.
I don't know. It's just sort of this, like, you know, you can tell he's a smart person. He's on top of things. And also doesn't care that people think he's mad, which I think is a really admirable quality. as somebody whose default setting is rage, I find that really enjoyable. And I feel like a lot of people try to hide their anger when they're authentically mad. And Tommy Lee Jones happens to be angrier more frequently than the average person, and also more okay with showing that.
You're right. And he just lives in this weird space where it's like, you're either having the time of your life or you hate this. And for some reason, they're the same thing to you. And that's really fascinating to me.
Yeah, it's like there was that moment at the Oscars this year where Ellen told a joke. And I don't remember what the joke was, or even if it was about Tommy Lee Jones. But they did the audience cutaway and cut to Tommy Lee Jones. And he just wasn't smiling, wasn't laughing. And I don't think he was upset. You know, if the joke was about him, I don't think he was angry. He just didn't find it funny, and he wasn't going to politely laugh for no reason. And that's, I think, the essence of Tommy Lee Jones is he's not going to lie to you to make you feel better. And I love that about him.
Yeah, no, there's absolutely just this cold but sincere vibe about everything he does that just like pervades everything he does. And it's just wonderful. Yeah.
Well, and the fact that he is a legitimately good actor. Like, I mean, you look at this, and then 14 years later, he's in No Country for Old Men, which I think is, you know, despite their characters holding similar positions, I think is a totally different type of performance. And he's the anchor for both movies, and he's the half anchor for The Fugitive. I think totally the anchor for No Country for Old Men, and I think he's amazing in both in totally different ways.
Yeah. And just him saying, well, you can blame me, I'm the one who shot him. And then that's the end of a conversation for Tommy Lee Jones. Like, that's hang up, leave the room. Like, that's just over. And that's like, and that's him being sincere. Like, he's not lying. He's not doing anything to, you know, impress or trick anybody. It's just, everything is just so cold and out in the open with him. And it's I don't know. It's wonderful all the time.
Absolutely.
All right. But back to the future. This will only get derailed by Tommy Lee Jones' appreciation a few times. Other than like visuals, what's your main criticism of this?
I guess it all ties into the direction. For the most part, is that, and I suppose the writing a bit as well, just that I don't find the action sequences very engaging.
There's not a ton of them.
There aren't, but
you don't like, I don't think that's what people like about this.
Yeah, and that's fine. But if it's an action movie, then I don't know. I should the action sequences should be engaging, right? Like
I agree. If you don't like the action while there's action on screen, then that's
a problem.
That's a problem.
Yeah. And I just sort of felt like, and it's weird because I'm the last person generally to complain about the pacing of a movie, but the pace in this movie just felt so off. Like, it felt like there was just 20 minutes that could have easily been cut out and you would have lost none of the plot. And I don't know. Like, I remember, and things that didn't need to continue on just kept going on. Like, I like the very, very end action sequence of this movie. Not once they got off the rooftop, basically. But the rooftop sequence is so long that when they get on the elevator, and I'm like, oh, okay, they're good. They're passed out. Tommy Lee Jones will get. And then the elevator starts going down. I was like, fuck. Like, this sequence just kept going. And it was those types of things that I found really problematic, that everything was too long. And even there was just something about the train sequence. It must have been in the way it was staged that it just sort of felt like a wasted opportunity, you know?
The L train or the original when he escapes from the...
The original when he escapes. Okay. Yeah. I don't know. It was a great idea. I really enjoyed that sort of suspense of, you know, you're in a place, that place is about to explode. You need to get out of that place. You know, that's a thing that I enjoy. And there was just something about it that I found so, I don't know, just lackadaisical.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I agree with a lot of the rooftop stuff being bad.
Yeah.
Because, like, not to say this movie is ultra-realistic, but that seems to be the goofy part, where it's these two doctors having this fight on a rooftop, two mm-hmm. people we don't really know, really. The antagonist is obviously capable of doing bad things, but it doesn't seem like he wants to be the one to get his hands dirty doing
exactly.
it.
Yeah.
I have a problem. I have a lot of, like, I think the last like 20 minutes of this movie is probably the worst parts for me. Like, that's where I think the bad choices were made. I think this could have been kind of a cooler, smaller movie. And that's the part where I think it gets away.
Mm-hmm.
But you said something about, just being able to cut things from this movie. And so there was one thing that I wanted to ask you about, and I wasn't sure if you would really like this or really hate this. The kind of red herring scene where they raid the house to find the other fugitive, Copeland.
That scene is, I think it adds more to Gerard's character. Not anything that I think is essential, but the I don't bargain line is pretty important, I think, to him.
Okay.
Because it sort of sets him up as, you know, he's the law. He doesn't view, it's kind of like what we were talking about with Tommy Lee Jones. He doesn't view any other opinions as correct if they're not his, you know?
Right.
And that's very important for Gerard's character, because it does build to the end of, you know, Kimball and Gerard riding off together into the sunset, you know?
Yeah.
That's what the whole movie's building towards, is them entering the movie in vastly different ways, but exiting the movie in the exact same way. So it's important for that. I don't love the scene. The house raid for the Kimball's landlord, I thought was really cool. I like that a lot.
Yeah, and that's another thing I kind of wanted to ask you about. Okay, so the first scene with Copeland.
Yeah.
It's really, I mean, okay, so you stated that you feel it kind of adds to the characterization of Gerard, Tommy Lee Jones.
Yeah, Sam Gerard, right?
Sam, yeah, let's go with that. It's Tommy Lee Jones to me and everything.
All right, fair enough.
Or Harvey Dent, either way. just from a screenwriting perspective. So this is an action sequence, I don't know, probably like 7-8 minutes.
I think it's much shorter than that.
Okay. It's an action sequence that really is pretty tangential to the actual plot. Like, if we're thinking of this movie as Richard Kimball's story, this doesn't have much to do with that, right?
Right. Nobody would come out of this movie and being like, hey, what happened to Copeland? You know?
Yeah.
Not even the actor that played Copeland.
Right. But I guess what I'm getting at is, like, a lot of movies like this, you know, like maybe a murder mystery or something like that, have a lot of red herrings, and mm-hmm. it's like a line or a character. This is a red herring scene.
Mm-hmm.
This is set up with Gerard and his team talking about, you know, we got to go get him. And it's, you know, kind of vague, but we just assume it's Kimball because that's the only thing we've seen all of these characters talk about for the entire movie.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to know if you thought that, like, what you thought of that idea, if that's like a cheap way to inject some action into a movie that didn't have a lot of action and maybe needed some. Did you think it was kind of, a clever setup for a cute little payoff, and then you just kind of get your heart racing again, you learn a bit more about the character, and you move on? Like, just from kind of a grip perspective, that's a scene you can cut and really not lose much. But that's not a thing you would cut, in your opinion?
Well, I think when I was talking about how I feel like there's 20 minutes I can cut out of this movie, yeah, you can definitely tighten up the climax like we talked about. But I think like when I was saying, and maybe, you know, the St. Patrick's Day parade part, if that could probably go entirely, right?
Yeah, you could. I think it makes the movie better, but I see your point.
Yeah, but for the most part, what I was talking about when it feels like there's 20 extra minutes, I mean it's like mostly fat. Like when people are complaining about the pacing of Clint Eastwood movies, that is just like endless shots of people thinking, that type of thing. Or I guess yeah. Terrence Malick movies, which I love and wouldn't change at all, even though like very frequently there's just no dialogue in these endless scenes. And they're just engaging to me, whereas it felt like there was so much fat on every scene just in the fact, like, the way that conversations were cut in such a measured way.
You're not talking about cutting entire, like, you're not looking at this outline of the script and saying that scene's gone, that scene's
exactly.
gone. It's just like, let's take out this line, maybe cut this a minute earlier.
Exactly.
That kind of cut?
Okay. And to go back to your question about red herrings, I think in general, if you can pull it off, it's good. I think it's cool. And I do think the cut from that meeting to the actual raid is very abrupt, and it's kind of weird. But yeah, I like the idea of red herrings. And like I said, the other big red herring in this movie is probably my favorite scene, because it's this real moment of suspense. And
which scene do you mean?
Where the Kimball is sure that the cops are coming for him, but they're actually there for his landlord, because
right.
Kimball's yeah. trapped. Like, there's just he's about to give up, basically.
He's in a basement. He has no weapons. I don't think he would use one if he had one.
Exactly. Well, I mean, we see him get rid of weapons frequently in this movie, or at least twice, you know. And yeah, it's yeah, he's trapped, and he's just like, well, I guess I'm trapped, and then it's just not for him, and that's great. Yeah, and so I like the idea of red herrings, and I don't think that the Copeland one needs to be cut entirely, but I feel like you could have gotten that. I feel like Tommy Lee Jones / Sam Gerard shooting at Richard Kimball later in the movie kind of gets the same thing across, the I don't bargain idea.
Right.
Because he is applying lethal force in a moment that should not involve lethal force.
Yeah. And I guess I just mean like this kind of idea of a whole scene that's a red herring is what gets me about that. Mm-hmm. The scene itself, I actually really like. I like all of them kind of walking up and having their own characters. I like seeing Tommy Lee Jones in that hat.
Oh, have you seen U.S. Marshals?
No.
Okay. There is a raid sequence. I believe it's the opening of the movie.
He's wearing an even better hat.
I don't even want to tell you what he's wearing, but it's fucking amazing.
Maybe I'll check it out.
You should, if it's from what I recall, it's in the first 10 minutes. There's also a really amazing Robert Downey Jr., Joe Pantoliano conversation in the first 10 minutes. So
that sounds great.
Yeah. And that's... it's still coked out RDJ. So it's even got that extra level of zest.
That feels much to me.
I'm sorry?
That feels like a drunk watch.
That is probably correct. I loved it as a 14-year-old. So ipso facto, drunk watch.
Drunk mid-20-somethings or just 14-year-olds?
I'm officially in my late 20s, James.
Oh, no.
Speak for yourself, you 26-year-old bastard.
Yeah, I'm so sorry.
Yeah. I don't care. Whatever.
No, I know you don't. It's quite all right. The landlord's kid getting arrested was good, and I mean that actually ties into the plot. Like, he kind of uses the information about Richard Kimball to move on. Like, I thought they would get some information out of Copeland or something, and it's mm-hmm. just like, it's such an isolated scene.
Yep.
But that's
yeah
fine.
it's for Gerard, because they really try and make this movie a two-hander, and that's why, you know, you cast such a good actor opposite Harrison Ford. You know, it's not like a movie where, you know, the one side of the equation is that much more important than the other. They probably don't have that big of a difference in screen time. I'm certain Harrison Ford is on screen more, but It's probably much closer than one would guess.
Yeah.
And that's the Gerard scene. That's the scene where we learn basically nothing about Kimball and a lot about Gerard.
Yeah, nothing about Kimball at all. Like, it's, as I said, it's really very unrelated to his whole story.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, now I just want to watch U.S. Marshals. Okay. yeah, it's one of those movies. Like, I mean, this is a trope that we see often, but it's the cop and the criminal who, you know, are more alike than they thought, you know, and then we see that at the end when he takes off his handcuffs in the car. Mm-hmm. And we assume they're, I don't know, golf partners for the rest of their life or something. I don't know.
Well, if Kimball's hand heals up.
Get that.
Sorry, what?
No, I was just saying, if you like, you get that vibe from them, yeah, kinda coming along.
Yeah.
Did you see any of the alternate casting for this movie?
I think I saw Gene Hackman for Gerard.
Yeah.
Which is
entirely fitting.
Oh, 100%. And
just the French Connection character again, Popeye.
Exactly. Yeah, and I would have no problem with. I don't think I would like the movie any less if Gene Hackman was in this movie. Another person with documented rage issues that I'm a fan of, you know?
Yeah. And John Voight.
Yep. Okay. He would have been, of those three, he would have been the least interesting, I think.
Yeah. And to, like, I see where they're coming from, though.
Yeah, absolutely.
And for Kimball, Alec Baldwin, Nick Nolte, Kevin Costner, and Michael Douglas.
I think they made the right choice.
Yeah, I think so too.
Oh, they 100% made the right choice because Harrison Ford's got that box office clout, you know?
Yeah, he does.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, I was just reading about that. What was it? Like, at one point, he had 4 of 6 of the highest grossing movies of all time.
Yeah, you emailed me about that. We talked about it a little bit. It's like, I assume those were both Indiana Jones and or Star Wars movies, or all, yeah, 4 of them in some combination, right? Which, I mean, it's still impressive, but you know, he's not the most important thing about Star Wars. He's the best actor in the Star Wars movies, but
judging by the post Star Wars career of everyone involved in Star Wars.
Yeah, exactly. But it's not like those nerds that were seeing Star Wars 7 times were going back just for Han Solo, you know?
No, those are the people who would beat up those nerds, is the Han Solo times.
Yeah, the Han Solo is how they got those John Travolta and Carrie type characters into the theater.
Putting some 1977 nerds on blast right now.
We're coming for you, past nerds.
did you read anything about what like kind of a shit show the production of this movie was?
It really felt like a movie that was rushed. And
yeah, I don't mean like Apocalypse Now kind of nightmare, but I just mean like just exactly what you said, just thrown together and like started filming before the script was completed. Mm-hmm. A lot of cuts, like, and just a lot of subplots left on the editing room floor. Both Jane Lynch and Julianne Moore's characters were like supposed to be a love interest at one point, which is funny to me.
Yeah.
And yeah, seeing them show up was funny though, eh?
Well, I mean, this is, can I run through my questions about the credits for this movie?
Sure. Go ahead.
Because it was really unique. Now, you said you've seen this movie a lot of times. I saw this movie once in high school, and that's about it. Like, I wasn't the biggest fan. I feel like this movie would be really enjoyable to watch one time.
I saw it a bunch of times as a kid and then hadn't seen it until now for probably like at least a decade.
Yeah. Because I remember enjoying it in high school, but never, I mean, anything I really enjoyed in high school, I watched more than once, you know? So the fact that I only ever watched this movie once, I think is kind of telling that it's really enjoyable for one viewing. So I totally forgot about these opening credits, and right off the bat, they are confusing. There's the this weird graphic for the names Harrison and then Ford, like at different times, and then is it Tommy Lee and then Jones, or is there some weird separation there too?
Yeah, it's either Tommy and then Lee Jones or Tommy Lee then Jones, but you're absolutely correct.
Funny Tommy Lee Jones story. While we're on the Tommy Lee Jones separation, I didn't know what Motley Crue was in the 90s when I was a kid, and for a number of years, I thought Tommy Lee Jones and Pamela Anderson were married, and we just colloquially referred to Tommy Lee Jones as Tommy Lee. So, yeah. Anyway, back to the opening credits. And then Julianne Moore is credited fourth in this film, despite having like 3 minutes of screen time.
This is why.
Sorry, yeah, exactly. That makes sense. But that's still weird. And then the credits just go away for about 10 minutes, and then they come back. And it's very confusing. It's like, make up your goddamn mind. And then the end credits begin in such a weird way. Like, the car is driving off, and then just three random names pop up on the screen. Like, just a continuation of the never-ending cast list. It's just three names in a totally different font from the cast scroll that starts immediately after. And then eventually that fades to black. Did you watch through the whole credits?
No, I did not. Okay,
so the credits fade to black.
There's fireworks, right?
It fades up for a cityscape, and then there's like 10 seconds of fireworks. It fades back down to black for the Warner Brothers logo. It was fucking insane. I had no idea what was going on.
Oh, I'm so glad you watched that all the way through.
I was just baffled.
Like, no, that's weird as fuck. So opening credits last 14 minutes.
Yeah.
And this is a two-hour movie.
Okay, they probably last five, but there's a nine-minute break in the middle.
Okay, but we're not done with credits until an eighth of our way through this movie, yeah. Which is fucking insane.
In Eternal Sunshine, it doesn't even start the opening credits until like something like the 18th minute. Like, they go through the whole prologue, but there's no separation once they start.
Yeah.
So that's the really bizarre thing to me. But yeah, I don't know. It's
And Eternal Sunshine can make some weird artistic choices like that, whereas yeah, exactly. The Fugitive should not be doing such
whereas
thing.
All of my complaints about this movie have been that it's so workmanlike, you know, and just all of the easiest choices are made in the direction, and then they just decide to get real weird with the credits.
Yeah, okay, so to speak to that, I think this movie had a deadline.
Yeah.
And then they just started, as I said, incomplete script when they were going. It was shot in 73 days, mm-hmm. which is pretty short for an action movie. Mm-hmm. And it's like in the business, at least, it's somewhat famous for having one of the fastest turnaround times mm-hmm. on post-production mm-hmm. because they pushed up the release date. They had six editors on this movie, which I guess most movies have two to three, and to have six is just completely insane. Mm-hmm. So they had like two editing machines with three editors working on each, with Andrew Davis like looking over their shoulders and telling them how to edit this.
Yeah. I think the Rock had something like that going on too. There were four separate editing rooms and Michael Bay was jumping between them.
That's craziness to me.
Yeah.
But you're right. I do think some of this shows up in the movie, mm-hmm. and especially when I read about what these characters were supposed to be. Andrew Davis, I guess, submitted a 2 hour and 10 minute version, which is 10 minutes longer than the final running time.
Really? The movie I watched was 2:10.
With credits, though?
Yeah.
Yeah, this was like before credits.
Gotcha.
And then he made 1600 cuts to do the things that it sounds like you wanted him to do, like just tightening up scenes and just cutting like little bits of dialogue and cutting a few like small subplots. Mm-hmm.
Is that an exact number?
1600 exactly. Well, I don't think IMDb trivia would lie to me.
Oh, yes.
Did you like the St. Patrick's Day scene? You kind of briefly brought it up.
Not really.
Steadicam.
Sure. There's a lot of Steadicam in this movie.
And not even that could win you over, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, it's... There's a different, like, Steadicam can be a very utilitarian way to shoot a movie. You know, or you can add some artfulness to it. You know, there's Paul Thomas Anderson Steadicam shots, and then there's Andrew Davis Steadicam shots. Yeah, no, it's fine. I can't really totally remember where it falls into the story. Obviously, he's back in Chicago, but it really felt like if you're cutting one entire sequence, it didn't feel entirely necessary. Because does it come out of just after Kimball escapes from Gerard in that courthouse or wherever they are? Or the hospital?
It's in the jail because he's visiting.
I don't know where they are ever because there's never a fucking wide shot in this movie.
It's after he's like running down the list of one-armed men and
gotcha.
Goes to visit one of them who's not the guy he's looking for, apparently.
Yep. Okay.
Oh, yeah, I thought that might be like one thing you kind of liked.
I like the L train sequence.
Yeah. I like in that part the when he's shooting at him through the bulletproof glass.
Oh, yeah. That just felt like when Kimball's escaping from Gerard.
Yeah.
Yeah, that just felt weird to me because, I mean, instead of stopping to shoot at him through something you can't shoot through, or even trying to shoot at him at that moment, like, keep running, he is trapped, you know? Like, it really felt like, I don't know, I just sort of felt like... Ethically,
we need more gunshots in this movie.
Well, it was just a weird time to shoot at Kimball. Like, and I just really felt it was unwarranted in general. Like, he's just running from you. He's not attacking you. Just don't shoot. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's... But
or shoot
Gerard,
for the...
Man. Gerard doesn't bargain.
Yeah, I know. And that's kind of my problem with Gerard as a character. It's like, I don't want all law enforcement to be like this.
Yeah, I guess my read on that is he's trying to go for the intimidation thing. Like, there's a part where he's down, and Gerard obviously understands that this glass is bulletproof, mm-hmm. and then he just takes two more shots that would have gone right through Kimball's brain if it weren't for the glass. And I think it's just meant to be like, no, this is serious. Mm-hmm. We're gonna kill you if you keep running.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I feel like they could have tried harder to actually catch up to him.
Yeah, I thought he was going to shoot him in the foot, and then we're going to have like
right?
100%. Because it looks like he can snipe. Like, he's shooting his like right in front of his face.
I guess we're still one year away from Speed, so we're not shooting for the kneecaps just yet.
No, not quite. Yeah. Pop quiz hot shot. You shoot him in the bottom of the foot.
This is way before Keanu and Jeff Daniels.
Yeah. You want to know one part of this movie I really don't like?
Absolutely, I do, James.
Is the line, "You missed your stop" on the L train.
Oh, I hate that. See also Copeland, "Be good" or whatever, as they're getting away from the train.
No, see, that doesn't bug me at all.
Oh, that bothers me a lot. That Kimball should be afraid of Copeland.
Well, he knows he's good. Like, Copeland's not going to do any harm to him.
I know, but he shouldn't be joking around. Kimball's terrified. He's a convicted murderer for something he didn't do.
Barely survived a near miss with death.
Exactly. He's shaken up. He's not Han Solo. And in that scene, he's Han Solo. Yeah. But I agree with your, I forget what the line. Oh, you missed your stop. Yeah, that's garbage.
Oh, it's such trash. Yeah. It is such trash.
Again, I think that's the line that led to Jeb Stewart's Wikipedia page being how it is.
Yeah, I mean, I think most of the poor decisions in this movie are made in the final third of it, and that's a big one. What I do like, and I think it's because it's so bad in that same sequence, is his like super punch when he stops the train and just uses all the momentum to deck him.
Yeah,
that part I liked a lot.
Yeah, I forgot about the super punch. And do you like that Katie's dad from Mean Girls is the cop that gets shot?
Yeah, that's wonderful.
They make a joke about that on Scrubs because he played the janitor on Scrubs as well. It's really funny.
Oh, that's where I recognize him from. Not that I watched Scrubs at all, but
yeah, anyway, continue.
There's a couple people in this movie I was trying to pick out. Yeah.
Jane Lynch.
Yeah, that was a nice pleasant surprise.
I thought you would be pleased.
Oh, I was so happy. It's like 93. Yes. Do it up, Jane.
Looks exactly the same. Mm-hmm.
And I didn't hate Julianne Moore, which is a nice stretch for me.
Oh, come on. Julianne Moore is wonderful.
She's really not.
Okay, go fuck yourself.
You know how bad Julianne Moore is? She was in a Jurassic Park movie, and I still don't like her.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
So for an action movie, for an action like hero, I guess, Harrison Ford never kills anybody.
Yep.
And that's kind of like that thing I was saying about how this could have been like kind of a cooler, smaller, like a bit I don't know, off the beaten path action movie. Like, yeah, that's one of the things that totally fits in with that. And then, you know, they do some goofy things that really gives that whole personality of the movie away.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's just sort of, there's a lot of, I don't know, there's a lot of interesting things, or maybe interesting is a strong word, but there's a lot of things that could have gone a lot better than they did and just sort of don't work out. And yeah, Kimble never does kill anybody, which is enjoyable. I mean, on this podcast, we've talked about how Will Smith goes through the entire climax of Enemy of the State by hiding under a table while everybody else shoots each other.
Yeah.
Despite his weird out of character use of a shotgun in a couple scenes before. But yeah, that's interesting to me, and I like that. And yeah, it's just, I don't know. It's cool, but and they never draw attention to it, which makes it more interesting. You know? He's just a guy that really wants to prove he didn't murder anybody, so he's not going to murder anybody and trying to prove his name.
Yeah, that would be a little counterproductive to his goal of convincing people he's not a murderer.
I'm not a murderer.
I just want
and
my
if you come
back.
At me, I'll kill you.
Kimble Super Punch. No, that's the thing. I really like Kimble. Like, I like this. Like, the Doctor is the main character. You know, he's rich enough. He doesn't need the life insurance, which is something they talk about. Mm-hmm. He knows how to treat his wounds, which is always cool to see someone in an action movie actually do that with an excuse for being able to be that good at it.
Yeah.
And he has access and knowledge of all, like, the medical stuff for the hospital, and that, you know, helps him pursue everything. It actually really made me want to watch the TV show that this is based on.
Yeah.
Like, you can see, you know, when he, like, there's a point that I kind of forgot about, having not seen this in so long, that there's a point where, like, he's kind of in the clear. Obviously, he's still a fugitive, but they don't know where he is in the country. His look seems to be fooling everybody. Like, there's a point in this, I was just thinking about it when they said it. I was like, how long has it been? Like, it's obviously been a while. And they said, you know, it's been a year. Like, I love that idea of a fugitive being kind of gone that long and getting, you know, he has a job at the hospital now. He's got his own whole new look. Like, I'm fascinated by that idea of this fugitive who's, you know, on the run, but kind of on the jog. Like, he, like, it's like he's not, like, he's had time to catch his breath and reassess, and, you know, he's, like, reading up on prosthetics and, you know, working a shift at the hospital long enough to be able to sneak into the one room he really needs or something. Mm-hmm. Just kind of as a long-term thing, I think, like, it's, I don't know, that's super fascinating to me.
Yeah, I don't think the movie gets that time thing across very well at all.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, it's something I was thinking about, and I think that's kind of another really interesting thing about this movie that's just not extrapolated and maximized, you know? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Like, the idea of him kind of just having a life now, like, having a life as Desmondo or whatever his name is. I like the when he is doing that research in the prosthetics department, when he's got the broom up against the blinds.
Yeah.
That's one of the, you know, I'm a sucker for, like, kind of those little things about how you get away with something.
Yeah, that, and the other thing I assumed you enjoyed was, as Harrison Ford, in that scene that ends with his foot being trapped, him coming around the corner and saying, there's a man back there with a gun screaming and threatening a lady or something. And then that's how Sam Gerard gets slowed up.
Yeah.
Oh. I assumed you'd like that.
Absolutely. Like, cause
that's a real flashlight on the fan sort of moment.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just something that, you know, it gets cleared up in about 11 seconds once he shows the badge, and once his buddy there, you know, shows his badge and explains it. But it's that 11 seconds that he needs to get away.
Yeah, exactly.
How about him saving the kid's life in the hospital? Did you hate that?
No, I didn't hate it. I mean, I think it's it fits in with his character. I thought him, like, in the open, like, holding up the X-ray was kind of goofy. I laughed at that shot. The point of view shot from Julianne Moore's position. I laughed at that because I was like, come on, get around the corner first, you know? But
and he explains it as being a hobby of his.
But yeah, that, and when he the cop that gets found under the train wreckage, you know, and they have to take him to the hospital, Those two moments are nice, where we actually see him be a doctor, that despite the fact that it doesn't really help him at all. Those are nice, and I feel like kind of fit into the Kimball character.
And two things that lead to his, not demise, because we know he gets away with it, but mm-hmm. is just, he's putting himself at risk.
Like, absolutely,
just let all these things pass. And, you know, he approaches that stretcher knowing who it is and could just walk away when it's the guard or the cop.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And then with the other one of bringing the kid downstairs, he could drop it off where it needs to be dropped off and walk away. But he's, you know, literally signing his name on.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's doctor's handwriting. You can never read that.
Yeah, anymore. Exactly.
Did you enjoy the armed robbery joke?
Yeah, I was that a joke? Was that definitely a joke, or was it just a poor choice of words? Or am I thinking about a different scene? Because I know the term armed robbery is used a few times in this movie.
It's used once, and at that point I would agree with you, where like maybe that was just a joke. But then later on, someone on Gerard's team says, like, very explicitly, we're looking for a guy with one arm who committed armed robbery. Isn't that kind of funny or something?
Okay. Yeah, I don't remember that. But like, there are a couple like when Harrison Ford's calling that list and the guy that's in jail for armed robbery, I was like, you could have picked another another crime. And also the that cop from The Dark Knight, there's a press conference later on in the movie where he says armed robbery again. It's just a combination of that term in this movie and that guy that was just really funny to me.
Yeah. And then there was a nurse on rollerblades for other seemingly goofy choices.
Roller skates, James.
Were they?
Yeah. Huh. Doubled up on the wheels.
I didn't notice.
You got to get that balance in a hospital.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, those are hospital-issued roller skates, I guess.
They matched the scrubs.
I didn't notice.
I noticed all roller skates.
So you said you had a lot of questions. Is there anything we haven't...
All of my questions were based on the credits.
Okay, well, allow
me to... we've put those appropriately on blast, I think.
Allow me to reiterate, always use fireworks during your credit sequence.
Oh, man. And it was, like, overlaid. It was, like, it was so weird. I don't even know. It was, like, they were combining two shots. It was very bizarre. I was confused.
that's quite clear.
Yeah.
Anything else about The Fugitive? Well, Ford?
Yeah, we haven't talked about Harrison Ford a lot. And other than the fact that we pointed out this movie is successful pretty much exclusively because of his presence, I think. Like, this would have been potentially a hit without him. Like, if, say, Alec Baldwin is Kimball. But it's not a cultural sensation without him, you know? It's not nominated for many Oscars without him. And I think that really sort of speaks to... it's also something that could never happen now. Like, who's the person that you could put in the middle of an action movie now that's, you know, based on a pre-existing property, but not one anybody's particularly excited about a movie version of?
40 years after that show's done.
Yeah, exactly. And... this just doesn't exist anymore. And I've been watching a handful of Harrison Ford movies recently, knowing we were going to do this podcast. And there really is kind of a Harrison Ford genre in the late 80s and the 90s, up through about Air Force One is probably the last one of these movies that was really successful, where it's just Harrison Ford in peril and having to dig his way out of it. And they're all kind of very similar movies, but all enjoyable. I think of the ones I watched, Fugitive, I mean, I've seen Air Force One, you know, thought it was fine, but The Fugitive is better than that. But I thought Witness and Frantic were both better than The Fugitive, but they all revolve around something happening to a Harrison Ford character and then him hiding or trying to search out the real answer. And these movies all come out in maybe 8 years, an 8 year time span. And it was just really fascinating and they were all entertaining. And I feel like they all worked exclusively because of him. And I found that really interesting. And
yeah. And I was thinking about the, as you said, the Harrison Ford character. And it's one of those people who I think, you know, that's the case. It's not that he's always the exact same person or anything and has no range, but you know, he's hitting the same note pretty frequently.
Yeah, he doesn't have a lot of range.
Yeah. And I just think part of that is, especially knowing his story, you know, he was like a cabinet maker who, you know, just met George Lucas, you know, doing carpentry. Yeah. And then I don't want to say lucked in, because obviously he was working at it, but just got this role in this movie that was just massive, being mm-hmm. Star Wars.
And everybody that got cast in Star Wars lucked out. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I know there's like American Graffiti and everything, but like he just, and again, I don't want to make it seem like he didn't earn it or he didn't deserve it, but it's just like so many of his characters, I just feel like he found himself in this place, in this like kind of overwhelming place that he's not really fully prepared for, and then kind of has the skills to do it. You know, it's like you are a very funny, naturally charismatic, handsome dude, and you can pull this stuff off. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I guess a lot of action movies are based on someone like kind of a fish out of water scenario where they're put in something they're not used to dealing with. But as you said, it's so constant with him. It's someone just, you know, kind of unwilling to do it, but he has to, and he can think on his feet, and he's a reluctant hero. And I think he's kind of a reluctant actor. I think he enjoys it, but I think in a large sense, he was kind of thrown into it and then just found himself as like, oh, I'm a gigantic movie star now. Okay. I have what it takes to do this, but I just don't see all the steps there. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. He kind of applies the carpentry idea to acting. He treats his job like a job, and he does a different version of the same skill every time. Yeah. You know, and you know, generally with good results, at least at the peak of his career. But I don't think he was under any illusion that he was the next Brando. You know, I think he was always very aware of his place in Hollywood and continually actively played into it for a long time. And yeah, I don't see any problems with it. It's just sort of the way he approached his career, and just keep working, you know?
I know, absolutely. It's kind of like a very blue collar thing. And
it's a blue collar thing with the whitest of collars,
the gold collar job. Yeah. And I was looking over, his IMDb, and they have kind of his trademarks is one of the sections they have under trivia. Frequently plays characters who use intelligence rather than physical strength. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that speaks to everything we were just talking about, right? Like, it's someone who not really has all the anticipated makeup to do what he does, but he kind of, you know, figures out a way to do it and just applies himself exactly where he needs to do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, by the time he first plays Indiana Jones, he's like 39 or 40, you know?
Yeah, no, and that's arguably his biggest role. Like, I know Han Solo is very big as well, but it's...
Yeah, the Indiana Jones movies, I would call it his biggest role, like, as far as him as an actor, because those are the movies that just revolve around him, you know? He's way more important to those movies than he is to Star Wars.
Yes, he is those movies.
Yeah, exactly. He's Indiana Jones.
Yeah, and I've just seen him... looking over his roles, he's played a villain like twice in basically a 6-decade career.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's had the chance to do whatever he wants being as big as he is. He's not a goody good. I mean, it's kind of different in The Fugitive because, you know, that's just kind of a well-respected doctor who has all this stuff happen to him. He always plays a good guy, but it's not, you know, the goody two shoes, like super clean cut good guy. Like, he's, you know, a scoundrel as Han Solo, and I think a scoundrel in so many things he does.
Yeah.
But yeah, he just kind of occupies that space where he's, you know, on the good side of the spectrum of good and evil, but he's not the Boy Scout, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I texted you about this recently, that Captain Phillips is the best Harrison Ford movie that doesn't star Harrison Ford. Yeah. And
it's absolutely bang on.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, you could make an argument for whether or not Harrison Ford would be able to pull off that last scene. But other than that, like, it's, I think that movie's better with Harrison Ford. But it sort of made me think about Harrison Ford and Tom Hanks as comparison points, because you know, both have the peak of their career in the 90s, aren't totally you know, the same age. Hanks is younger, but I think culturally we look at both of them as sort of different versions of America's dad. You know, America's, like, Tom Hanks is the much more loving dad, whereas Harrison Ford has got that old school vibe, like, you know, if you came out to him, he might disown you from the family, you know, like, there's always that chance with Harrison Ford, you know, but Tom Hanks is the much more loving. And I think it just sort of really, but I feel like they sort of capture the space of how we look at father figures. And I think both of their successes, even though I think Tom Hanks has had a bit more of a varied career, I think a lot of his big successes kind of come as him playing this sort of, sort of paternal guy, particularly Saving Private Ryan is the key for that, you know. But yeah, I just sort of see them as different versions of America's dad with different parenting styles, but they both come back to the same thing, that we just want to trust that they're going to guide us through something, you know.
Yeah.
And they're going to get us through this crisis.
Yeah. And like the intelligence versus physical strength, and kind of the blue collar thing we were talking about, even though it doesn't necessarily apply to being an actor, but you know, that's just, there's such like dad paternal traits, right? Like, yeah, just, you're just someone who shows up every day and does your thing, and it's not something insanely remarkable about you other than the fact that you've done a very good job of not being insanely remarkable at anything.
And
that's not to detract. I think they're both good actors, and they're both people who, I can't think of a lot of movies where they make it less enjoyable doing what they do. It's just, it's not the super handsome, super flashy kind of guy.
Yeah, Harrison Ford's pretty fucking handsome, though.
Yeah, that's true.
And he's got, like,
not in that.
And he's, like, for a 50-something guy in The Fugitive or late 40s, he's pretty goddamn cut, you know?
Yeah. Like, let's not do this.
I mean, you kind of called Harrison Ford not handsome, but his handsomeness is very integral to his appeal.
Yeah. He's a Hollywood leading man handsome, but not, like, he's handsome enough to be an A-list actor, but not like in a pretty boy kind of way. You know?
Exactly. He's old school handsome.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Great hair, strong jaw. There we go.
There it is.
And a scar. A notable scar.
And a left ear pierce.
Lest you think he's a bitch.
he got that cut when he was young, but he's not gonna tell you about it.
Yeah. He'll just punch you in the face instead. Give you your own cut. Thank you for listening to The MacGuffin Man. Again, be sure to check out our website, themacguffinman.com. We don't know what we'll be talking about next week, but it's the fall season, so we're about to be able to talk about new movies again, so I can't wait.
And TV?
I'm sorry?
And TV.
Perhaps. I can't think of anything, but I suppose there's no point in wasting more of our listeners' time. We'll solve this off recording. So thank you for listening to this podcast, and be sure to check out whatever our future podcasts are.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.